not always politically correct, but always correct, using only primary source stories of those who were actually there. You're listening to Threads of Liberty. December 7th, 1941, a day that will live in infamy. But it's also a day in which a battle was waged that actually ended up saving America.
We're telling this story today because of something that happened about 30 years ago. I was just beginning teaching, and I was also working part-time in my mother-in-law's health food store. As I was up at the front counter, an elderly gentleman with white hair and piercing blue eyes, and I mean Paul Newman type eyes for anybody that remembers Paul Newman, walked in and he asked me where something was. Then he went to the back of the store looking for it, couldn't find it, came back up again. And as he approached the counter where I was at that time preparing my lesson for the next day in class. And we were preparing to talk about Pearl Harbor. And as he walked up, he looked down and he saw something that grabbed his attention. And it was a picture of the USS Arizona in flames. And he said, "What's that?" And I explained to him, it was my class for the next day. I said, "We're talking about Pearl Harbor." And this elderly gentleman with his piercing blue eyes started to tear up. And he looked at me and he said, "I was there. I didn't think anybody remembered anymore." And he was tearing up. I teared up. And I promised him that from then on, every year I taught, I would teach about Pearl Harbor. It didn't matter if we were talking about world history. Somehow we got Pearl Harbor in there. So today we are talking about Pearl Harbor, and the strangeness of it is we're talking about how Pearl Harbor saved the American Pacific Fleet and basically, in the end, won the war against Japan.
That's going to be interesting because I don't think most people associate Pearl Harbor with any kind of miracle.
No, it's not normally a success story. It is a story where we lost 21 of our battleships, either badly damaged or sunk. We had pretty close to 3,000 Americans die that day. Up until 9/11, that was the worst day for America in our history. But this all goes back to 1937. We're going to talk about the Japanese a little bit to lay the groundwork. The Japanese in 1937 had begun an expansionist war. They were moving into China. They were moving into Indochina. They were moving into the Dutch East Indies. And the reason was, in order to fund or to finance and to have materials for their war expansion, they had to go to these countries because Japan has no natural resources, or at least not enough to fund a war. And the Japanese were brutal about this, extremely brutal. And this is not a condemnation of any country now, but the fact is, at this period of time, Japan was brutal.
Yes.
They had been into China in 1937. In a six-week period in what is called the Rape of Nanking, they killed over 300,000 innocent civilians. When Jimmy Doolittle and his boys bombed Tokyo, some of them crash-landed in China, and the Japanese killed 250,000 innocent Chinese because they dared to help the American pilots escape.
Wow.
During the period of their expansionist time, they killed between, and we don't know exactly because there's no way to know exactly. They didn't exactly report them. But the best estimates are, is that during their expansionist period, the Japanese killed between 10 and 16 million innocent civilians.
That's mind-boggling.
So this was what Japan was doing during 1937, 38, 39, 40, everything leading up to World War II. They had a problem, though. Japan has almost no natural resources. And the reason they were expanding into these other countries was, especially the Dutch East Indies, is because they had crude oil. So they wanted to go down there, take over the Dutch East Indies, and use that as their source of oil to fund their war that they would eventually carry throughout the world. They had a little problem, though, with the United States. We owned the Philippines at the time. And the Philippines stands right next to the passageway that Japan had to go through in order to get to the Dutch East Indies.
So we were kind of in the way.
We were major league in the way, and we gave them warning after warning and said, "Listen, if you don't stop this, we're going to interfere, cut off your passageway by the Philippines. You won't be able to get down to the Dutch East Indies." And this went on and on and on for years. And finally, it came to a point where we issued an ultimatum. You either stop this or we're going to cut you off totally. So Japan then had to come up with an answer to this. The answer was either A, they bow to the United States' request and buy their oil from us, or B, they go to war with us so that they can conquer the Dutch East Indies and have their own crude oil. Obviously, they chose B.
Correct.
And hence we have December 7th, 1941. But I want to clarify one other thing also before we get too far into this real story, because this story actually is the story of the hand of Providence in the attack on Pearl Harbor. And you don't normally associate the hand of Providence with Pearl Harbor. But I want to clarify something. This was not a surprise attack. I get so tired of people saying, and you read it all the time in the newspapers and books, this, look at your history books. The heading will be surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. There was no surprise attack. There was study after study after report done by the American government itself. And one of those, I believe you have. And this was done by an Admiral Walter Ansel. And this was only one of four studies the American government did.
So this was done in October 1940. And he said, the security of the U.S. Pacific Fleet has been under renewed study. This study, in part, has been promoted by the increased gravity of the situation with Japan.
Point number one, they knew there was an increased problem with Japan.
If war ever begins with Japan, it is believed easily that hostility would be initiated by a surprise attack on the fleet at Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, I'm not laughing right now, but I am grinning. The report flat out said this war would be started by what? A surprise attack at Pearl Harbor.
Right. And then it goes on to say the inherent dangers to the fleet warrant taking every step as rapidly as can be done.
Okay, so that was the instruction. Take every step as rapidly as can be done. This report was issued in October of 1940, 14 months before December 7th, 1941. But this was not the only one. There were three others. One of them was a year later in October of 1941, another on November 24th of 1941, another government report on November 27th of 1941. And let me just read a couple of parts of this November 27th of 1941 report. It said in one of the opening lines, and this was to Admiral Kimmel. Now, some of these names we need to clarify, I guess. Admiral Kimmel was the admiral in charge of Pearl Harbor, the base itself. So this first line says, this dispatch is to be considered a war warning. Now, if you're a general and you get a dispatch that says this is a war warning, maybe it ought to get your attention. Mm-hmm. It went on to direct the admiral to, quote, execute an appropriate defensive deployment. Get yourself ready, for crying out loud. You're in Hawaii, but they're coming for you.
Did he?
No, we'll cover that in just a second.
Okay.
Because the final sentence was this, hostile action is possible at any moment. To answer your question, did he? What he did was he pulled his ships in around Ford Island, which is the island that's right in the middle of Pearl Harbor.
So we bunched them all up together?
Bunched them all up together, which honestly wasn't a bad idea at the time because they thought that was the way that they thought we were going to fight that war was only with ships. And he was going to bunch them there because the Japanese couldn't get at them. Mm. They weren't thinking airplanes. You have to remember, this is World War II. Our last World War, World War I, we had not used airplanes in this way. So this is a new type of a war.
So but we underestimated it.
Oh, we underestimated it. I was going to say we were surprised, but we weren't. But the other thing he did is he placed a good number of his men on shore leave and let them take shore leave.
Oh, sure. Why not?
But this was not the only warning we had. We had an apparatus that was a decoding machine called MAGIC. And the United States government, the United States Navy, intercepted five different messages from the Japanese describing the attack on Pearl Harbor, beginning with 2 years before when the Japanese recreated on a small island by Japan, Pearl Harbor, so they could practice the attacks. So we had five Japanese attacks that we heard about from the decoding. We had four of our own reports. This was not a surprise. It was a sneak attack, but there was no surprise to this.
Well, at least not for those in charge. I think for the average military person, it probably was.
Yeah, the normal enlisted man had no idea what was going on. For the normal enlisted man, he was in Hawaii.
Yes.
And they talk about this many times. The major thing that the nurses had to deal with in Hawaii was sunburn, severe cases of sunburn of sailors that just weren't thinking. But that was the good side, the beautiful side of Hawaii. We all know then at 7:55 on December 7th, 1941, the Japanese came in with about 350 planes. They chose Sunday morning purposely. because they knew that our boys would be getting ready for church or sleeping in and skipping church, much to their parents' chagrin. The Japanese had spies out. They didn't really need to spy. The one spy that they did get reports from took a tour around Pearl Harbor that was sponsored by the Navy.
Oh, how easy for him.
He took a flight over the top of Pearl Harbor. There was some commercial enterprise that somebody was involved in. He bought postcards to show the layout of Pearl Harbor.
So things weren't exactly a secret.
No, no. Matter of fact, as the Japanese fleet was coming in, he was sending them weather reports that he was getting on the radio that day for Pearl Harbor, so the Japanese would know exactly what the weather was going to be like that day.
Goodness.
But it was a horrific day. It was a surprise, as we mentioned, to our enlisted men. This was a day of heroics. We talk a lot about heroes in America. Some of them are, some of them aren't. The young man you're going to read about next was an actual hero. And this is at the bombing of the USS Arizona that I believe most of us know. Over 1,100 of our young sailors died that day in that ship.
Horizontal bombers flying at about 13,000 feet dropped armor-piercing bombs almost simultaneously on the battleship Arizona. One sped straight down the funnel and blew up the ship's forward magazine. Instantly, torpedoes joined the bombs and the forward part of the ship blew up. Bodies flew 300 feet into the air, hurled about as tiny particles are whisked aloft in a fire. The after part of the ship shook as if it would fall apart like a stack of cards. There was a great swishing sound as fire and smoke pushed up through the seams of the deck. 20 men were caught in a turret. A hot blast enveloped them. They felt a pressure on their eardrums. Nauseating gas and smoke smothered them. There was confusion and danger of panic. But at one command, quiet, not a word was spoken. A seaman produced a flashlight, and they found their way through the thick smoke to the ladder. The man sent to open the hatch took a long time, but the men waited quietly in the heavy smoke. When the hatch was opened, they burst out upon an amazing sight. The forward part of the ship was a mass of flames and shattered, twisted metal. Bodies lay thick on the deck. Men were running out of the fire, falling on the deck, jumping over the side. Japanese planes were flying low over the ship, strafing the fleeing seamen. Out of the chaos, the men heard a voice of calm reassurance. "Take it easy. Don't get excited. Leave the ship for Ford Island." It was the surviving ranking officer. He went into the flames, and many who came out with him were so badly burned that they were barely able to stand. They stumbled along, feeling their way helpless, yet not a man gave way to panic. The officer worked swiftly, surely, and took no shelter from the Japanese who continued their strafing. Many of the wounded, and some of those unhurt, would have failed to get off the burning ship had it not been for this officer's courage. Men took heart from his calmness, forgot about themselves, and turned to help others escape. "When are you leaving, sir?" someone asked him. "Not until the Japanese leave," he answered through the flames. When the last boat pulled away with the final load of wounded, he leapt overboard and swam ashore.
So this officer of about 25 years old didn't even take up the last spot on the boat. He dove into the water and swam across this oil-covered water that was actually on flames. And the other thing to remember is this, you know, when we talk about providential events at Pearl Harbor, that's one of the first providential events, I think, is we had a Navy force that was full of 19-year-old boys. These young men were 1 year away from graduation. So picture your senior class, and that's pretty much who we had there. And we were going up against the Japanese Imperial Navy. So it was a miracle that we survived that day. The Japanese's main effort that day was to bring America to its knees and bring us to our knees quickly. It could have been worse. We did lose 3,000 of our young men and women. We did lose 21 ships that had to be repaired, three of which were not able to be repaired, the Utah, the Arizona, and the Oklahoma. The Arizona still sits at the bottom of Pearl Harbor. But we're going to go now and talk about a man by the name of Admiral Chester Nimitz. Admiral Chester Nimitz was the head of the Pacific Fleet in World War II. So this is not a bystander. This is not some ordinary officer. This man was in charge of the whole show. This man knew exactly what was going on. He knew exactly what was happening. And we're going to talk about three, and I'm going to flat out call them miracles, that he refers to at Pearl Harbor. That if these three miracles had not happened, the Japanese would have destroyed the whole American fleet. And then they would have been able to execute the second part of their plan, which was the invasion of California. They were not able to. If they had been able to do what they wanted to do, there would have been no American fleet to protect the western part of the United States. So let's take a look at the very first miracle number one that Admiral Chester Nimitz refers to.
When the Japanese saw all those battleships lined in a row, they got so carried away sinking those battleships. They never once bombed our dry docks opposite those ships. If they had destroyed our dry docks, we would have had to tow every one of those ships to America to be repaired. As it is now, the ships are in shallow water and can be raised. One tug can pull them over to the dry docks, and we can have them repaired and at sea by the time we could have towed them to America.
I'm assuming we know what dry docks are.
Well, I think they're where you repair ships.
It is where you repair ships. So the dry docks were directly opposite where the ships were at on Ford Island. It's where you took the ships to repair them. If they had destroyed the dry docks, and if we had had any ships to be repaired, where would we have taken them to be repaired? We're in Hawaii. The closest part of America is California. So you're going to be towing those ships all the way to California with no other part of the American Pacific fleet to protect those ships as you towed them.
Well, and considering they'd been given postcards with aerial views of Pearl Harbor, they...
How did they miss that?
Yeah, exactly.
So that's miracle number one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad they did miss it.
Yes.
Let's move to miracle number two. And this is, again, please, everybody remember, we're quoting Admiral Nimitz.
Every drop of fuel in the Pacific theater of war is in the top of the ground storage tanks 5 miles away over that hill. One attack plane could have strafed those tanks and destroyed our fuel supply. That's why I say the Japanese made three of the biggest mistakes an attack force could make. Or God was taking care of America.
Even Nimitz recognized God's hand here. So 5 miles away were the oil reserves. If you don't have any oil reserves, I don't care if you have ships. They're not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Try to get in your car and go with no gas. It's the same idea. Why they didn't destroy those oil reserves, you can chalk it off to chance or luck, if you will. Even Nimitz says it was by the hand of God that these oil reserves were saved. Third miracle. And this one to me is the most important.
It was God's mercy that Admiral Kimmel didn't have warning that the Japanese were about to attack Pearl Harbor. If we had been warned, our fleet would have gone out to sea. All our ships would have been destroyed one by one in deep water. We would have lost the entire Pacific fleet and 18 to 19,000 men, instead of the ships and 3,300 men we did lose.
It's really difficult to look at Pearl Harbor and say it could have been worse. But it could have been way worse, according to Admiral Nimitz. Our ships were World War I era and Spanish-American War era.
Oh, that's old.
Yeah, the plating on the sides that kept the ships afloat and kept them from being pierced by the Japanese armor was very thin. The armaments were not of the caliber of the Japanese. If we'd have gone out to war in the Pacific, the ships that ended up in the bottom of Pearl Harbor would have actually ended up in the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. And that's where they would be to this day. There would be no way to pull those ships off the bottom of the Pacific Ocean, get them back to a dry dock, and get them fixed.
Or rescue the men that were on them.
I believe he said we'd have lost, instead of the 3,000 we did, we'd have lost 18 to 19,000 young men. If it had not been for something that looked like it was catastrophic, and that was the sinking of these ships in Pearl Harbor itself. If it had not been for that, the Japanese plan would have been successful. They would have dropped America to our knees. There's no way we could have recovered. There's no way we could have built enough ships fast enough. As it was, only three ships remained at the bottom. As I mentioned, the Oklahoma, Arizona, and Utah. The other ships were repaired in the dry docks. They were fueled from the oil reserves from 5 miles away, and they were sent out to go back into battle. Within 6 months, the vast majority of these ships were now replated, rearmored, and fighting the Japanese, many of them at the Battle of Coral Sea.
I think you said there was a fourth miracle as well.
There was a fourth that Admiral Nimitz did not refer to, so this one people can argue with us if they choose. But we had at the time in our fleet three flat tops, three aircraft carriers. And these aircraft carriers were crucial because the battles that were to come in the South Pacific were to be fought from carrier to carrier using airplanes. If they had sunk our three aircraft carriers in Pearl Harbor, we couldn't have fought those battles. We would have had no ships, no aircraft carriers to carry the planes. But providentially, or lucky, I guess, as the textbooks would say today, or by chance, those three aircraft carriers were not in Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. They were out on maneuvers. The Japanese were stunned that they weren't there, couldn't find them, and thank heavens they did not.
Sounds like a miracle to me. You know, there's big miracles and there was even little small miracles for individual people. There was a young farm boy who had not been trained in how to use the standard rifle that they used.
I think there were a lot of young farm boys in this.
But this one says all available arms were put into use. A country lad from the West had a standard rifle shoved in his hand. Get out and shoot was the command. The boy had not been trained to handle a heavy rifle, but he had done a lot of hunting in his day. So he drew a bead on a small dive bomber coming in and fired. One of the freak accidents, or miracle, of the war occurred. Apparently, his bullet hit the detonator of the bomb the Japanese was about to drop, for the plane burst in midair, and the young man was so shocked he fainted.
Yeah, that's one of those one in a billion shots. You hit the detonator on the bomb as the plane is flying at you. You know, the Japanese had no idea what they were getting in for when they bombed Pearl Harbor. Yamamoto, who was the head of the Japanese Navy, had lived in America. He'd gone to Harvard. But the Japanese as a whole looked at us as what they saw in the movie theaters. Mm. We were gangsters. We were thugs. We were playboys. We were surfer boys. They did not think there was any way that America could pull itself back up by the bootstraps and fight the kind of war that would need to be fought against a very, very, very experienced Japanese Imperial Army. They didn't think that we had the strength inside that they felt they had. The Japanese actually felt they were superior to the Americans in that way. And honestly, they had shown it. America was just now coming into the world to be seen. The other thing that the Japanese didn't think we would be able to do was pull together the diverse nationalities that we have in America into one fighting group. We had white. We had African American. We had Latinos. We had Asian. There are several reports from the Japanese referring just to that fact that they did not believe that all of the different nationalities in America could unite and fight for a common cause. And I fear that if that were to happen today, they would probably be right. Mm-hmm. There is so much separation, so much pulling us apart as a country, that if and or when the time comes that we do have to unite together, black, brown, Asian, white, whatever it may be, I don't know that we could do what this greatest generation did. I guess we would.
We hope.
Because we would have to rely on the very same thing that that greatest generation relied on. Strength of character, strength of values, and the hand of providence to lift them. But it would be a very different type of America now as opposed to then. But this greatest generation, there's a reason why they're called that. There's a reason why that elderly gentleman that walked in touched my heart. I've told this story a number of times, and every time I get a little emotional thinking about it. But I also get emotional thinking about the fact that he thought that nobody remembered Pearl Harbor anymore. And we've talked about the fact that we stand on the shoulders of those who have gone before us. We've talked about on the Alamo, and this greatest generation, the generation of, at least in our case, of our fathers and of our children's grandfathers, these were young boys that were not experienced in war. Right. Most of them, as my father, when he went into the Navy at the age of 17, he went to his parents to get a permission form signed by his parents to go because you had to be 18 and he was only 17. His parents wouldn't sign it. So we went to his brother, who conveniently was in the Navy, and his brother signed it for him. So my father ended up in the Navy. But that was the type of generation they were. They wanted to defend their country. They wanted to fight. They wanted to be there. The Japanese miscalculated hugely. They did not understand the American character, and they did not understand that the hand of providence would be there for America when we need it.
Well, and in fact, General George Patton, another very famous World War II general, said this about those young men. "It is foolish and wrong to mourn the men who died. Rather, we should thank God that such men lived." We hope you'll join us again for our next story of Threads of Liberty.